We're going to go on ahead and get started. My name is Sarah Beth Myers, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the Vanderbilt Journal of Entertainment and Technology Law, and I would like to welcome everyone to Lights, Labor, Action. Just so you know, we are filming this, as you can see, so if you do need to step out for a moment, if you wouldn't mind kind of sneaking out quietly and making sure the door doesn't bang on your way out, but we just hope that you enjoy yourselves for the course of the day. It's going to be a lot of very interesting and hopefully entertaining panels. So with that, I'm going to introduce James Gibson, who will then introduce our first panel.
Morning, guys. I'd like to go ahead and introduce our panel. We'll start down here on the end closest to me. This is Professor Gene Marsh. He's the James N. Kidd Professor of Law at the University of Alabama School of Law. He spent 9 years on the NCAA panel Committee on Infractions, including time as the chair of that committee. He teaches a variety of courses at the University of Alabama, including a class devoted specifically to sports law, and he recently took an of-counsel position with the Birmingham firm of Lightfoot, Franklin & White. Next to Professor Marsh is Naima Stevenson, who is Assistant General Counsel to the NCAA. She spends much of her time looking at infractions and enforcement matters, and she has been with the NCAA for about 3 years now. She began her career as an associate at the Washington, D.C. offices for Arnold and Porter. Next to Ms. Stevenson is Professor David Williams, who is the Vice Chancellor for University Affairs. Here at Vanderbilt, he wears a variety of hats. He is General Counsel, Secretary of the University, a Professor of Law, the Department of Athletics in the Division of Student Life reports to Professor Williams, and he teaches a sports law seminar here at the law school. Next to Professor Williams is Mr. Dan Cohen, who is an associate with the firm of Kasowitz, Benson, Torres, and Friedman in Atlanta, Georgia. He spends most of his time practicing matters related to gender equity and Title IX issues in the realm of college athletics, and he is an alumnus of Vanderbilt Law School and the Journal of Entertainment and Technology Law. And next to Mr. Cohen is another Vanderbilt alumni, Mr. William King, who is a partner at Lightfoot, Franklin & White in Birmingham, Alabama. He spends his time on a variety of litigation matters, labor and employment issues, and a large portion of his practice is NCAA compliance issues. He's represented schools from the Southeastern Conference and the Big East Conference. And to moderate this panel is Mr. Clay Travis, who is an author and a sports blogger. You might have read his columns, The Clay Nation, or you might have read his work on the sports blog, Deadspin. He has written two books about college football. One is Dixieland Delight, which was a fan's guide through the Southeastern Conference. And the other is the forthcoming HarperCollins book, On Rocky Top, a fan's front row seat to the end of an era, a book chronicling Phil Fulmer's last season as coach of the Tennessee Vols. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and get things started.
It's good to see everybody this morning. I think we're going to have a good time. I think you're going to learn a lot of interesting things, and I know we have a really extremely august panel here. We've all sort of gotten introductions already. I think we're going to allow everyone to introduce themselves. I'm Clay Travis. I was here, graduate 2004, and I'm excited about this. For all of the interest and extreme pleasure and delight and whatnot that we get from college athletics, most of us really have no idea, and I know myself included, the inner workings of how NCAA rules, regulations, infractions are examined. And I think that we're all going to learn an awful lot to sort of undergird. Everybody who's been paying attention to sports knows about the Florida State controversy, for instance, that's going on right now. We sort of all hear about these controversies, but really don't have a great depth of knowledge, I don't think. Certainly I don't. I don't think most people do. The individuals on this board do, and they can share a lot of that information and make us understand some of these issues in a way that maybe we haven't before. So without any further, I guess we'll just go straight across to the panel here and let everyone introduce themselves, and then we'll get rolling. I know at the end we're going to have questions from the crowd. Is there a particular time that we want to start taking those questions?
You can spend about the last 15 minutes.
Okay, perfect. Well, take it away, Mr. Marsh.
All right, we had, I think, 7 possible discussion points put on the table, and I was saying I thought we could spend probably about a month on each one.
Right.
So I'm going to, first, before I forget, I wanted to thank all of you for this gathering. It's been really first rate. I mean, it has been. The students here and everyone else in the school building who worked on this, it's been terrific from my end anyway, as far as knowing what's going on and the setup and the dinner last night and whatever, and I really appreciate it. I'm going to speak I've got lots of notes here, but I'm going to talk fast. I'm not going to talk about the Florida State case. I'm going to talk about a couple of the subjects that were on the list. One of the subjects was, it basically stated this way, and that is, does the NCAA drive the bus, or do the members drive the bus? That is, you know, is the NCAA, folks, at least in my part of the country, you know, there's no love lost in the state of Alabama with the NCAA, and usually evokes some form of dog cussing when you just mention the expression. And it's been my impression in 9 years on the committee, and then the years that I was faculty rep at Alabama, as David was faculty rep at Vanderbilt, that folks, I think they have a sort of an upside down opinion and often wrong about who drives the bus. That is, it is true when people in Alabama say, "What's the quote NCAA doing?" or a coach rails against a rule or whatever. I can remember an exchange I had once with a basketball coach in the SEC, younger fellow who was quite vocal and had a fuse, you know, pretty short. And I won't tell you his name, but his first name was John and his last name was Brady. And he was blowing a cork at one of the SEC meetings about a new rule that had been implemented in basketball, and he was describing it as the NCAA, as though the rule had fallen out of the sky and had been implemented by the NCAA. And I knew right away, I thought, you know, if I talked to the people at LSU, they probably asked him about the proposed legislation, and I'm guessing that he didn't weigh in. Sure enough, they asked, he didn't weigh in. And then he comes along later on and is blowing a gasket about the new rule, and I was also guessing that his institution voted for the rule, which they did. So it is, at least my first point is that the extent to which people complain that about the quote NCAA is in many cases the fact that you've sort of done it to yourself. The very people who complain about the rule are often fine that their own institution may even have been involved in the development of the rule, but also voted in favor of it. And it is true that the NCAA gets on the front end, the entity, they meaning the building in Indianapolis, gets on the front end of some issues, maybe sometimes more than they should. But the fact is there's more continuity in those jobs and in that building than there is in all these committees that exist. I mean, committees, you know, the nine-year term of the Committee on Infractions is a really unusual thing. It's three-year terms. Most NCAA committees are far shorter in as far as your life cycle goes. And so what you end up with is legislations being developed. You have an incredible amount of turnover of the people who are involved in that debate over the course of a couple of years, both people who are back on campus, who are dipping in and dipping out of the process, student-athletes, there's a, you know, issue. One of the subjects is, are student-athletes involved not enough? And the answer is they are not involved enough. But on my campus and in everything I've ever done with the NCAA, student-athletes are sometimes infrequent participants because of lack of invitation, but sometimes with full invitation just don't show up. You know, they don't show up for meetings of athletics council meetings on campus. And although some, when they get involved in student-athlete advisory committees, are very heavily involved and you can count on them being there, many times they're not. So one of the problems with the NCAA sometimes sort of being on point on stuff is just the fact that in the legislative process and whatever, there's many times, a lack of continuity that exists in the other people that may be involved. And then I'll say two other things and then pass the wand. Another issue that came up was, or maybe just one more, and then I'll pass the one. Another issue that was on the list was, you know, are coaches paid too much? And the answer is yes. I mean, sure, they are. But, you know, I think things are a little bit more complex than that. In the 9 years that I was on the committee, no matter what the case, it seemed to me that you could, in many cases, you could boil it, how did you get here? You got here because of, if you had to pick one word, I would say money. In other words, there's so much money at stake in winning. There's so much money at stake in the coach keeping his or her job, whatever, or the school wants to win so much because of all that follows from it. Money has an incredibly corrosive effect. Money has a corrosive effect. You know, we're dealing with this economy that we have, which is in large part a function of mortgage lending madness and whatever, and the corrosive effect of money and the bonuses and the compensation systems that were in place for people who were chief executive officers of those companies who were trying to hit their numbers for Wall Street You don't have to go too far to see the corrosive effect of money. When it comes to coaches, and I mean not just some money, but the kind that makes the headlines, you know, where your head football coach is making X amount of times what your president makes and whatever. Most schools say, that's a gamble that works for us because we may be paying the coach $4 million, but once we get our football team in shape, it'll be netting, you know, X million dollars. And that may be true for a few schools. But, you know, so much of NCAA legislation gets shaped not by the people in the building in Indianapolis, but by the battle between the haves and the have-nots. And that's something that I think took me a long time to understand is the extent to which in the NCAA, although sometimes the NCAA gets blamed for shaping legislation or being for or against something, the real underlying battle in the room that often shapes that legislation is the battle that goes on between the schools that actually make money, not many, and the schools that don't, who don't want to get involved in this bidding war. You know, one of these subjects is, will we ever pay athletes? I doubt it, particularly not in this economy. Can you imagine telling athletic departments right now that in addition to the hemorrhaging that's going on, you're going to pay athletes? The thing that matters to me when it comes to coaches is sort of what your brand is. And what I mean by that is last night in talking to students about what kind of great job offers they have, I mean, you folks here, the incredibly strong law firms and worldwide, world-class law firms with that kind of opportunity. What gets you those opportunities is being a student at Vanderbilt, which is known for what it is known for. You know, what does not get you that opportunity is the one loss record of your football team, the one loss record of your basketball team. It's the integrity of the place you have here, and it's the name that you have. That's what gets you those opportunities. I think the brand that you carry here is a great and strong brand because you're not branded as the place that pays the head football coach the highest salary in the country. You're about something different. And that, to me, is what we should be all about, is sort of what's your brand as an institution. I think you've got the right brand. So, you know, at some places, their brand seems to be to take pride in, we pay our head coach more than anyone else. That was my institution for a while, and then somebody's come along and outdone us. Somebody's paying more than $4 million a year. Go figure.
First I'd like to echo Professor Marsh's sentiments that this has really been a great event so far, and appreciate the invitation. I was actually a stand-in. Our general counsel got the invitation and wasn't able to attend, but I'm very happy to be here. I think what I'll do is just briefly give you a little bit about my background. I know many of you are interested in breaking into the sports law arena, so it might be useful maybe to hear a little bit about how I got to where I am. As James mentioned in the intro, I went to University of Maryland for undergrad, and I went to Harvard for law school. I practiced for 5 years as a corporate and securities associate at Arnold & Porter in Washington, D.C. I always joke that the SEC has a whole new connotation now that I'm at the NCAA than it did when I was at Arnold & Porter. One thing to note, you know, I know a lot of people say it's really challenging to get sports law jobs. I think that is true in part because the people who have the jobs pretty much stay in them forever. If you look at different GC's offices for particularly professional leagues and teams, if you look at the players' associations for the professional leagues, a lot of those attorneys have been there for a really, really long time. I was fortunate in that the opportunity at the NCAA was a newly created position. Our general counsel's office operated as a two-lawyer shop for over 10 years. Elsa Cole, our general counsel, used to be the general counsel for the University of Michigan and came over to the NCAA in 1997 as the first in-house lawyer for an association that's been around for 100 years. I found that to be fascinating. She quickly hired Scott Bierby, who's our associate general counsel, to deal more with the business-related issues for the association, and he got there in 99. So from that point until 2006, when they finally decided, okay, this is a lot of work. We might need to have a couple of additional lawyers, my position was created. As a private association, we can get sued anywhere where we have a member organization, and as you can imagine, that's pretty much everywhere. We've gotten sued. Elsa jokes a lot that there's very few states where we haven't gotten sued and where she hasn't had to go to defend the association in litigation. About a third, at any given time, we have about 20 to 25 active lawsuits going on, which is a lot. And about a third of those, I would say, are a byproduct of our enforcement infractions process on a wide variety of different issues, including negligence, whether or not we actually followed our own policies and procedures in the processing of a case or the deciding of a case as it relates to our infractions matters, defamation. You know, when the committee members may have characterized different individuals in a way that they found not too pleasing. We have those kind of actions. So anyway, my position was really created to work with our staff and our committee members and other areas in the association that have process-oriented functions to make sure not that we don't get sued, because we get sued pretty frequently, but that when we do get sued, we have dotted all the I's, crossed all the T's, followed our own policies and procedures so that we can defend those actions. As I mentioned, we have I was hired in 2006. In 2007, we hired a fourth attorney, so now we're a four-lawyer shop. And still the work is never ending. We have a lot of issues that come through our office which make it really interesting and fun to go to work every day. Everything from equipment manufacturers who sue us because we've changed our specifications on lacrosse sticks and whether or not as a rule-making entity we can do that. I would say yes, but an equipment manufacturer said otherwise, and we actually got a favorable decision in the Eastern District of Michigan just 2 days ago, so that was good news. To, you know, the type of issues that I've talked about as it relates to the infractions process, to major antitrust, you know, class action type litigation. So it's a fascinating place to work, and, you know, I'm ready to get into the discussion.
Well, I was not here last night for the dinner, but being an employee here, I'm sure you guys put on a very good show, and so I'm glad to hear my two compadres say what a great job Vanderbilt's law does. I was in Tampa while you were eating. I was watching our basketball team become crushed by a Jeans basketball team. And I just flew in, just got off the plane and came right here. A lot of in reading the stuff and listening, first off, I have to admit, in my seminar that I teach here, both Naima's boss and Dan actually lecture in my seminar. So if you want to ever hear a lot of people other than me talk about sports law, take the seminar. We basically have about 15 guests that come in. Some of the things that are very interesting that are going on, and I would say that in the college athletics, it's really a very, very changing environment right now, and part of it is because of the economy. But the interaction that I have with Naima and sort of in a small sort of crossover with Gene is I also serve on the Infractions Appeals Committee. And so when Gene would finish with them and Naima and Elsa would, you know, sort of doctor them up, they come to us because everybody appeals them. And it's interesting because we're sitting here talking about Florida State, and I won't comment on it either, mainly because probably within about 6 months we'll probably be hearing that appeal. And so you do have a system that's somewhat like a legal system that constantly keeps this thing going. And Gene's absolutely right. You know, it's I always say it's the us's of us. It's not the NCAA. We make the rules. And Gene is also right. Between both the Committee on Infractions and the Appeals Committee, that is sort of the really only committees that sort of stay intact. Both of those have 9-year terms, three 3-year terms, so you can sit on those for 9 years. very, very interesting work, and you learn a lot about what happens, I would say, to a degree that's really not really good about some of the stuff in college athletics. Gene made a interesting comment about sort of our brand, and one of the things was about one of the topics was about Vanderbilt's athletics. And you know, I'm always put in a position I have to correct what's said. Vanderbilt never abolished its athletic department. People seem to think that we did away with it and somehow our kids are just out there playing and there's no control or anything. We never abolished it. We basically did something very interesting because of who we were, in the sense that we are the smallest school in what we consider to be the toughest conference. We're the only private school. We have a very, very high academic standard to get in here. We're not a state school, which I think has an advantage, say, in the Southeast Conference, to be a state school from a money point of view. We basically tried to change ourselves to leverage ourselves. You know, that sort of thought of, you know, you try to find what your strengths are and structure yourself around that to get the advantage out of that. And Gene's absolutely right. One of the things we thought all along was, with no disrespect to the other millions of universities out there, that we have something a little different. And it starts with that concept of strong academics and integrity that we basically were going to build off of. And so we kind of changed the model a little. And we don't have an athletic director per se. We do have people that run the program. And if there's anything like an athletic director at Vanderbilt, it's me. And at the same time, I get to be the university's general counsel, which actually gives me a position of seeing things over time from two very, very distinct but interrelated views. The NCAA, while I think they've done a lot of stuff, and when I say the NCAA, let me make sure I'm saying us. It's not that building in Indianapolis. Where I do think they have not, or we have not done a good job, is on academic reform. And I think Miles Brand has tried, and I think there's been pushes, but just as Gene talked about those people that get in those committees, and you have the money group and the non-money group, at the end of the day, make no mistake of it. At the end of the day, make no mistake of it, college athletics is a business. It is a business. And money talks, and everything else walks. And so it does become a situation where I really believe the academics have suffered. I mean, we've sort of gotten right to the pinnacle, and then we kind of back down, and we're actually seeing some of that now in some of the reforms that were supposed to come out with men's basketball, which has a deplorable graduation rate. I mean, a deplorable graduation. And I challenge anybody that says we shouldn't be concerned about graduation rates in college athletics. I mean, that's ludicrous. It's at a university. You should always be concerned with graduation. coaches' contracts, I mean, I think that's another thing. Gene is absolutely right. We never will be the highest paid. But we hope we set up an environment where our coaches want to stay. And I think our baseball coach said it well 2 years ago. He said the great part about coaching baseball at Vanderbilt is, I know I'm not going to get fired just because I had a losing season. Well, the problem in college athletics now is you can have a winning season and get fired. And that's not going to happen here. We kind of see our coaches also as teachers. And so, no, we're not. I mean, and that doesn't mean you can just come here, coach for 15 years and never win. And that's not the case. I mean, we have dismissed coaches. But the fact of the matter is, you know, where else in America will you have a football coach that goes 2-9, 2-9, and then we give him a 10-year contract? You laugh, but that's the same coach that took this team, this school, to its first bowl in over 20-something years and won the first bowl. The last time Vanderbilt won a bowl game was the year Churchill stepped down. So it was worth actually doing that because we knew it was going to take time. So like everybody else, I'm happy to be here and look forward to interacting with you guys.
I'm Dan Cohen, and as Travis said, I'm a Vanderbilt Law School grad, and so I'm very happy to be here. I think that the Journal and Sarah Beth and James and everyone else, Brett, have done an outstanding job, and so I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to come back. Before I went to Vanderbilt Law School, I worked in three different athletic departments, and then once I was here, I had the opportunity to work in the general counsel's office at Vanderbilt in regards to Title IX issues. So I was in the industry before I was a lawyer. I work in the area of Title IX for the most part. I tend to represent universities, although not exclusively. Title IX really deals with gender equity issues. It's a little bit different than the NCAA issues. It's more of a core labor law issue in some regards, as the theme of the symposium is. Title IX is an area that is rapidly changing right now. In 2005, there was a decision handed down that gave private litigants a right to sue for retaliation, and we've seen a rash of suits since 2005 because of that. Fresno State alone is paying $18 million in settlement dollars to six coaches, and they just got sued for a seventh time. In terms of student athletes and opportunities for participation, there hasn't been a lot of developments since about 2005, but now that we have a new administration in Washington, D.C., I can guarantee there's going to be a dramatic increase in enforcement actions from a Title IX perspective. And to a large extent, schools are like sitting ducks. There is a lot of schools that have exposure right now. Not necessarily liability, but a lot of schools that have exposure. If you just look at the statistics, there are about 78% of all NCAA institutions that could be sued tomorrow. They won't necessarily lose, but they could be sued tomorrow. So there's a lot going on right now in the area, and we can talk about that as the panel goes along. I won't get too deep into it right now, and I'll pass the floor to William.
My name is William King. I'm from Birmingham. I work at Lightfoot, Franklin & White. Our firm has been very involved with Vanderbilt Law School for its entire 19-year existence. We sponsor the first-year appellate writing program. We're the guys that paid for the Black Acre where they had the good food last year, so you have us to thank for that. I graduated in 1989, and really glad to be back, because I love coming to Nashville. My wife's family's from here. I get to miss a day and a half of work, meet some new friends, and so this is great. What I do is I represent colleges and coaches in the infractions process, and that is always a process that my clients do not initiate and want to conclude as quickly as possible. I cannot tell you how interesting and fun the work is. I do litigation, the law firm I work for is litigation only, and it's just entirely different than lawsuits. And it really is fun. In addition to representing coaches and institutions in dealing with NCAA enforcement and Committee on Infractions, I also have help clients with drafting coaches' contracts, two kinds, one for the head football and basketball coach and then one for everybody else. And they're very different animals because there are more zeros in the first than the latter. And that is really interesting because what you try to do is basically look forward 5 or 10 years to the train wreck and then try to engineer backwards from that to make sure that you've covered every possible cause of the wreck to make sure the university is protected. And then you go negotiate with the coach and his lawyer, and the coach always, always, always has the upper hand in the negotiations because you are either hiring him or her, and that means you really are excited about them, and they are leaving somewhere to come work for you, or else you're renegotiating because the coach has just had a great year. So the athletic director sends me in to talk to the coach and his agent to tell them about all the bad things that we need to put in the contracts. They talk to him about the dollars. So it really is fun. And I think I figured out why I was invited here, because I have a perfect record in the last year against this panel. Naima, I represented a coach in dealing with NCAA enforcement, lost. I then went before Gene's Committee on Infractions. He was not there. Lost again. Was outraged and appealed it to David's committee and pulled off the hat trick, 0-for-3. Found out last month. For those of you who are interested in it, if it is, I was just lucky the way I got into it. And I won't bore you with all the details, but there are certain things that you can do to put yourself, I believe, in a better position to work on one or both sides of this business. and I'll be happy to discuss that with any of you afterwards. I won't waste time talking about it now. So I'm very glad to be here.
All right. Now we know everybody here. What I'd like to start off with, I think, and I'm going to scare Naima by coming to her immediately, is just sort of a baseline idea of where the NCAA gets its power and authority, and how does that work? Because I think we've already seen that the NCAA, it sort of becomes this huge target. I mean, it's representative. People rip the NCAA, and maybe people disagree, but I think there's probably more of a dichotomy between fan understanding of the NCAA relative to institutional understanding of the NCAA than probably anything else in the college athletics field. So if we want to start with there, and then if anybody else wants to jump in, and then we'll just get rolling.
I think Professor Marsh did a good job of setting the tone for this, but, you know, everyone seems to think that it's those people in Indianapolis that does whatever we do to institutions and to student athletes. As Gene identified, it's David Williams, it is the membership. It is the institutions that make this monstrosity of a manual that makes the rules that govern the association. The people in Indiana, so this is where we get our authority from.
Right.
We get it from our schools. When the folks in Indianapolis, you know, everyone from our office, we're positioned a little differently, but the enforcement staff, membership services, which has now changed their name for the millionth time, and now they're academic and membership affairs, our governance staff at the NCAA, all of these folks assist the membership, the committee structures, in, you know, making sure that we are interpreting our rules correctly so that there's equity amongst the universities, that we are enforcing our rules so that there are equity, that there is equity amongst our membership. So we get the authority from the members, and then really we're a service provider, all the employees at the national office, to help keep the intercollegiate athletic, you know, thing going. It takes a lot of work. Professor Marsh will tell you, and so will Professor Williams, that it is a lot of work for these committees, these two in particular, where they get boxes of information that they have to be, you know, very well versed in every time we have one of our committee hearings that are over a weekend. You know, so we're in a hearing room or a conference room at a hotel, and they're, you know, basically being briefed to death about every aspect of why an institution doesn't feel like the rule they broke should apply to them in that particular circumstance. It's a lot of work, but it's our members. It's each committee that we have at the association is made up of people like these two who are law professors or athletic directors or faculty athletic reps, and they are the ones who make the rules and enforce the rules with the decisions. So we get the authority from the membership, and we are really the employees at the national office in Indianapolis are a service provider to the membership.
I think there's a misperception that the NCAA employees aren't college sports fans. As sort of a baseline level, I mean, you could talk to that a little bit. I mean, you yourself are a college sports fan.
Right, and I was, when we were at dinner last night, they gave me the bad news, because I can't even watch Maryland's men's basketball because they will break your heart on a regular basis. I at least have the women to root for. I guess you guys do, too. Most of the people in the national office are either former student athletes, former folks that worked in athletic departments at institutions. We have lawyered up, for lack of a better way of saying it, in some of our positions because, you know, a lot of people look at our processes as being akin to legal processes, and they really are not. They're unique and administrative. You know, this is a private organization that whose members determine the direction in which it goes. Most of the people there, whether they're lawyers or not and working in non-legal capacities, are really avid sports fans.
Right.
Not all. I have a friend who works in our human resources department, and we have regional rounds in Indianapolis, and she didn't get tickets. We get two complimentary tickets to go to you know, any NCAA championship game, so that includes March Madness, which would be the biggest of those. We don't get tickets to the BCS games. We don't get tickets to football. That's totally different. But anyway, I was sitting talking to her. I said, I know you got your tickets, right? She said, no, I don't go to the game. I said, your husband is going to kill you when he realizes that the tournament is here in Indianapolis and she has no tickets, which she could have gotten for free.
For face value, yeah. Or for free.
No, we get two complimentary and then we can purchase up to two. So
wow.
That's a benefit of working at the association. I'm actually off to Miami next week for first and second.
That's a tough place
game.
To have to go watch games.
Tough place to go watch games. But, yes, we get the authority from the membership, and not all, but a lot of the folks who work at the national office were either former student athlete or have some athletic nexus, and they're really passionate about the work that they do to serve the membership.
Right. Well, let's get into a little bit about, we've talked about the member organizations, which are the universities and how they govern. A lot of the conflict, I guess, and you guys can speak to this, arises when an individual student athlete deals with a particular NCAA rule. In particular, do you all as a group, and anybody can jump in here, think that student athletes individually, you may think that the member institutions are treated fairly under the NCAA rules, are individual student athletes treated fairly? And an even more, you know, detailed perspective, shouldn't they be considered employees under the NLRA, since they fulfill several of the criteria that employees would need to fulfill? And I'm not going to direct this to anybody in particular, but feel free to jump in and run with it. And if nobody does, then we'll have an issue.
I can certainly start.
Okay.
I think people miss the you know, real baseline of the fact that these are students just like everybody else who happen to, as what they're interested in, that is athletics. So
right.
They're students first. That's why they're called student athletes. We would never consider a student at an institution to be an employee. Just like you guys are involved, you know, in this journal, you know, and this is what you choose to, obviously the journal, or maybe it does, I don't know, doesn't generate money for the institution. So I guess that's where the difference lies. But these are students. They should be there for academic purposes first.
Right.
And athletics is something that they're passionate about. I think of Courtney Paris at Oklahoma. You know, when you really sit down with these student athletes, there's probably a handful of them who probably do believe, and we saw that in the White litigation, that there should be some payment.
Right.
But when you think about $64,000, that's a lot of money. I know that I'm still paying student loans for both undergrad and grad school.
Right.
So here you have a young woman who is passionate about her sport, so much so that she wants to declare victory before a game is even played and is willing to put her scholarship on the line. You know, so no, I don't think that we would ever consider our student athletes employees. They're students at college institutions.
Okay, yes.
Every employer that I'm familiar with, it is the younger or newer employees who cater to the needs of the older employees. And the student athletes, at least the ones I'm familiar with, it's the opposite on campus. So I think in many respects they get treated a lot better than employees.
Right.
They certainly have more support staff than most 18 to 21 year old employees have. But I don't see how you could ever. I agree with Naeem, and there's no way you could consider them employees. I just don't see that happening, Clay. The thing that bothers me, and this is kind of getting to the pay-for-play issue, is that there are incredible demands put upon their time. And some of those are mandatory activities during the season. Then there's the off-season voluntary activities that I think the reality of the – I see Chris laughing. They're not really voluntary. They don't have time to do anything other than their sport and go to school, and which eliminates their ability to legally and validly go get a job and make some money so they can have money to spend when they're not doing sports and schooling. I do wish there was some way we can fix that without it becoming a true pay-for-play situation.
You know, I'm going to disagree a little bit, and I'm going to disagree based on where I think the profession is moving and where I think the real problem is going to come. The concept of this is that your payment, if you want to use it payment, is a first-class education. Well, there's two components of this that bother me as we move on, and I'll go back to when I went to college as a student athlete. Yes, that was what I got. I got a scholarship to get an education that was going to change my life. Well, the fact of the matter is now we've put in two different components back from those days. One is a huge amount of kids that are not getting the education. And while people will say, well, that's the kids' fault, remember, they are kids when they come. They're 18 and 19. And universities, quite honestly, allow some of these kids to be used by the university. The second thing is it does raise a question. When you start putting this amount of money in things, and the university is basically making money because they're making deals with Coca-Cola and Nike, and the coaches are getting $4 and $5 million, that you turn to the kid and you say, and remember, many of these kids come from backgrounds where they don't have anything. And so for us to basically have to have a special fund or have to get a waiver through our membership at the NCAA, sometimes to allow a kid to fly home for a funeral, I mean, the fact of the matter is we're creating something that where you both are very right in the sense that I don't think it's appropriate, but where I think is the outside forces are going to basically push the issue. I mean, how many times do you sign deals where coaches are making this, the university's making that, all this money is flying on these campuses, and the student-athlete isn't getting any of it in any shape, form, or fashion? I mean, what we have to go through sometime to provide one of our student-athletes something other than that garden variety scholarship is really scary. I mean, I'm constantly, I mean, you know, we're in situations where if there's student-athletes walking across this campus and my wife calls me and says, I just saw so-and-so. I just saw the men's basketball team. They looked real down after that loss. Why don't we take them to lunch? I said, you got to go call my compliance director to see if you can do that. And so we're creating an environment where I think there's going to be more and more push to somehow divide up the pie differently. And I think we're putting ourselves in a real bad situation because we really do have, you know, I can give you the name of two or three great men's basketball coaches in this country. Who have done wonderful things on the court and have never graduated a kid out of their program. How are they still coaching?
Gene, did you have something you wanted to add there?
This goes back to a point I made earlier about how sometimes you think that the NCAA is opposed to something and that's the way it gets played by people in the media, and then you find out sort of the underlying reality, and it happens to relate to student athletes and jobs. The first NCAA convention I ever attended was the last sort of big tent convention type. It was like in 1996, and it was here in Nashville. And it was a year when there was on the table this proposal to have more liberal rules regarding student athletes being able to be employed during the academic year, even if you were on a full scholarship. The idea it was. And I don't remember that's, you know, how many years ago, 13 or more years ago, exactly what the proposals were and how it all played out. But I can remember, you know, being wide-eyed going into that event for the very first time, thinking, reading in the head of time, the, you know, the newspaper articles are saying that the NCAA is opposed to more liberal rules regarding employment of student athletes, and that there's concern from the NCAA about cheating that might go on, because the concern was, well, if you let your local football players go get a job, you'll find out that maybe they're working at a car dealership and getting paid X amount of money and not doing anything but not showing up. So it was all that was the tone of the debate. Then when I get to the convention, what I find out, sort of the smoking room level of debate, which affected the outcome, is although the NCAA is getting tagged as being the bad guy in the process, what it was a fight between, once again, what I called the haves and the have-nots. But in the strangest way, coaches who were honest were saying, hey, if I can recruit a kid and say, you know, not only can you come and play for us, but we can get you a good job. And let's say you got a kid who's interested in medical school. Well, there sits our medical school, our world-class medical school. We can get you a job in a, as a research assistant in this world-class lab. The have-nots were worried about, and there are a whole lot more of those than haves. They were worried about, hey, if, what am I going to say to a kid if we're in a rural area? We can get you a job running a trot line or fixing fences or what? And so what it to me was really a vivid and probably a good first experience to understand that what gets portrayed as opposition sometimes by a certain group ends up with a vote that is in fact affected by this fight that is going on between the people who have resources and people who don't have resources. The easiest person, and believe me, I am not an apologist for the NCAA. I just finished a law review article that just went out a few weeks ago that is significantly more critical of the process, the infractions process, than it is kowtowing to it. But I do think many times the easy way out is for writers and bloggers and whatever to say, well, it's the big bad guys in the building in Indianapolis, when in fact outcomes in many cases are shaped by who's got the money and who's not. That's where the fight is, including the idea of compensation for athletes. Imagine a school like Alabama right now, which I think you know is definitely making some money in college athletics because of what's going on with the football program. Their ability to throw some money around to student athletes, and maybe not individually like paycheck, but just the funds or whatever that you can load up and fly somebody here, there, wherever. Unless that money is going to come straight from the NCAA as an organization and being distributed that way, if you just leave it up to institutions' own bank accounts, you're going to have a significant world of difference between what my school can do for you and what his or her school can do for you.
And I think that leads in well. I mean, we've all seen, for instance, football or basketball jerseys of individual college players. They're not allowed to be named, but they're numbers. And, you know, for instance, I was at Cool Springs Mall the other day out in Williamson County here in Nashville, and they had an entire row of Tim Tebow jerseys. I mean, 15 without Tebow's name on them. Clearly, I mean, it used to be that you could just maybe go to the bookstore individually in that jurisdiction. I'm sure Vanderbilt sells player jerseys. I know they have in the past. But maybe you had to go to the university bookstore or whatnot. Now, college football has become such a national business that Tim Tebow is a national figure. And you could probably buy a Tim Tebow jersey anywhere in the Southeast, certainly, I would think, and probably anywhere in the country that you needed to. This sort of leads into a sort of a provocative question, but then we'll sort of unpack it a little bit. And I was going to ask David Williams, because you would have the experience, what would happen if all of a sudden SEC schools were allowed to pay football players legally?
I think Gene hit it on the first piece. Is you'd have those that have more money. I mean, if it's paying out of their money, would be better equipped to do it than some others. I mean, if it was I think the SEC could probably get to that point on an equal basis if you took some of the surplus that the SEC makes, and as opposed to distributing to the schools for our budgets, basically say, here's the number of student athletes and here's what you get. You're going to have a problem, though, because you already created a problem in your question because you said football players.
Right.
So does that mean we don't pay the basketball
players?
That's
what I want to lead into.
We don't play the tennis players, and that would create a whole nother problem. I'm not in favor of paying. I just think we're going to have a hard time defending, but it would be a mess. I mean, it would be just a big mess if we decided to somehow take that money and basically pay the student athletes. But I think there's a way to change some of that, and that's, to me, the concept of what the scholarship is. You know, I remember back when I went to school, which seems like millions of years ago, you know, you actually had a portion of the scholarship grant and aid that actually, we used to call it laundry money, mm-hmm. which was actually a certain amount of money that you got a month in addition to that. And, well, we kind of put that on the meal tickets and stuff like that, but there's no reason why that number couldn't be raised. So it's at least to give some of these student athletes a little bit more cash in their pockets and a little bit more of that largeness that we're taking in from this industry.
Sort of back to the Tebow thing, is there any argument that that's not a fig leaf to allow individual jersey sales in that player's name, and probably not on an individual basis fair to him? I mean, that's millions of dollars probably in revenue.
Well, I disagree that it's not fair to him, because it seems to me that as long as you're not putting a name on there, that number belongs to the university. And I think that's the other piece that people need to realize. The name Vanderbilt does not belong to Jay Cutler. It doesn't belong to Earl Bennett. It belongs to Vanderbilt. And those colors are Vanderbilt's. And so, you know, whatever number Tim Tebow is wearing now, there could be another University of Florida individual that will wear it after he's gone. And so this concept is, whatever that number is at this point in time, that's really his jersey.
Well, unless they retire it, in which case nobody ever wears it again.
Yeah, well, you can always unretire it. It has happened.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, we've, you know, think of the ones that you retire and then the person gets convicted for mass murder. You go unretire that jersey real quick.
Let's lead in with Dan Cohen a little bit about this Title IX issue, because Title IX also gets, in the same way that the NCAA gets slammed, I feel like Title IX gets slammed sort of as if it's this huge bugaboo. I mean, people just go after it like crazy. Give us a little bit of a baseline about what exactly Title IX is, and then maybe if you could tie in how and why maybe it would be illegal to pay players under Title IX, or what you'd have to do in order to make it work under Title IX.
Well, Title IX is a very broad area of the law at this point. I mean, the law itself technically is 37 words long. That's it. Once you get into the regulations that interpret it, it becomes very broad. There are 13 different areas that are covered by Title IX. The most prominent two have to do with participation opportunities and scholarship dollars, which is really where this discussion to pay for play would come into. But then there are 11 other areas that have to do with the provision of equal resources, whether it's facilities or coaches or access to tutors. It's an incredibly broad area of the law. Purely from a Title IX perspective, if you were to pay players on one team, you would have to pay the other gender an equitable amount, an aggregated equitable amount. If you gave an extra $1 million to football and basketball players on the men's side, you would have to distribute approximately $1 million to the aggregate on an aggregated level to female student athletes. And there are some mathematical formulas for how you get your actual number, but essentially it's got to be equitable. Now, from the standpoint of paying players, I don't think it's ever going to happen. And it's because once you pay players, they become employees. And once they become employees, the NCAA, as we know it, is done. Once they are, and I'm not an NLRA lawyer, I can't really get into the nuances of when the definition switches from not being an employee to being an employee. But once you become an employee, they have the right to unionize. They have the right to then collectively bargain for more money. The NCAA would have to pay, or the member schools would have to pay workers' comp. Very expensive proposition. From an antitrust standpoint, the NCAA would likely lose the ability to qualify under the more lenient rule of reason. And instead, you're going to have a stricter antitrust interpretation of how payers are paid. Schools could not collude in order to keep salaries down. Combine that with the unionization and now the stricter antitrust scrutiny, and you would quickly get into an arms race. And frankly, the NCAA, as the body that kind of oversees the regulations, they would under the antitrust rules, they would lose the ability to regulate as we know it today. It would be the end of the NCAA. It couldn't happen. But as you get into alternative ways of going about paying players, not through monetary donations, but rather, as Clay was suggesting, restoring a right to publicity. Let them market their own names separate and apart from, you know, the specific jersey sales where the jersey belongs to the university, but a Jeremy Bloom situation perhaps. That's at least a possibility. Increasing the amount of laundry money that flows through the athletically related financial aid rather than a pure cash payment. That's, again, something that is a possibility. And I can't get into all the nuances about whether that would work or it wouldn't work. But just remember from a Title IX standpoint, if you were to increase the laundry money on one scholarship, you've got to increase the laundry money on all the scholarships and make it equitable. One other thing that I wanted to comment on is I spent 2 years working in minor league baseball as well. And from my standpoint, what players are receiving is equitable as compared to, or it's commensurate with their skill level. In minor league baseball, a first-year player makes $1,100 a month. They also get a $20 per diem for food. Once you get up to the AAA level, the Nashville Sounds, which is one of my former employers here in town, the average AAA player, one step away from the majors, more than 50% of them are going to make it into the major leagues. The average salary is between $55,000 and $65,000. Compare that to a Vanderbilt scholarship. According to the admissions office here, it is $52,000 a year for tuition, room, and board. And I think that also includes the meal plan. But athletes here are going to eat more than your typical student. They're going to receive medical benefits and other health benefits. And they're going to receive a lot more than just that $52,000 that your average freshman would be paying. So if you compare, and you have to look at the skill level. 1% of all NCAA athletes are going to advance to the professional level. So if you want to compare skill levels, the NCAA athlete versus the minor league athlete, yes, they're being paid in tuition rather than in cash. But in terms of just pure value, they're getting paid handsomely.
You said, just to clarify something on Title IX, you said that the men and women have to have equalized, proportionally at least, if you were to distribute money. And you said that's unlikely and everything else. If you pay football and basketball players, does that mean, do all men have to be treated equally, all male athletes and all female athletes, or just the proportions? And do you understand what I'm saying? If you gave $1 million and you just restricted it to football and basketball, which are the revenue-producing, typically, sports for men, and then you had to give $1 million to women, could you just restrict it to men and women, male basketball players and male football players, or does that money have to be equally distributed across the spectrum there, too?
There's no requirement within the gender. It's okay. An aggregated analysis.
Okay.
So if a university chose to pay only football players and only women's tennis athletes, that would be fine. Schools have tremendous flexibility under okay. Title IX to do what they want to do. But at the end of the day, on an aggregated basis, it has to be.
Let's move now a little bit into what Mr. King can talk about a little bit. Contracts with coaches. How do those come about? I know you've done several. Maybe we can talk a little bit about it because he's not employed by Auburn anymore. Tommy Tuberville, just sort of walk us through what happens when a guy like Tommy Tuberville comes in, is making X number of dollars, and how those contracts are structured and how the entire process works. I think that's pretty fascinating, and we don't necessarily hear a lot of details about things like that.
One thing that's common in colleges today in the revenue sports is the universities not only pay a base salary, they pay for all of the coaches' endorsement rights, radio, TV, internet rights as part of the contract. So where 15 years ago, a coach may have had a salary of $150,000, a football coach in the Southeastern Conference could make five or six times that in outside income, which he was free to do on his own. And the universities, I believe the collective thinking was, is we want our coaches focusing on coaching and we'll handle the marketing. So that's one reason that they've gone up so much. But I think realistically what happens is that when a university decides that they have to get a new coach or a new contract with their current coach, again, it's always because the coach is in the driver's seat, that it's really just about agreeing on the set amount. And I don't do that. You know, what my role is they give me the numbers and then you get with the coach's agent and work out all the details on that. And the dollars themselves are usually negotiated at a very high level directly between the coach or his agent and the AD or the president. And the details are where I think is the most interesting thing is, you know, making sure that you, in fact, have acquired all of the coach's rights. So when they have that undefeated national championship season, that you haven't left something uncovered. When this is, most of you were in elementary school, but Auburn had an undefeated football season in 1993. They paid their coach $155,000 base salary. End of discussion. The coach was wise enough to specifically reserve the right to do videos, postseason videos, of summarizing the season. Brilliant. And he made about $500,000 in back then dollars.
Right.
You know, probably $1.5 million, $2 million today just on the video, selling the highlights from the season. And so all of that has to be covered. The area where you really have the most push back and forth, the two areas, one is personal conduct clauses. I've after an NBA basketball player choked his coach and at practice, and his contract was terminated because of a personal conduct clause. Not that my clients had any similar issues. I suggested, you know, we may want to put something like that in there, and you know, that is such a nebulous. What is personal conduct? What constitutes grounds for termination? And are you going to interpret it the same way when I'm 13-0 as when I'm 3-10? Right. And all of a sudden, you're going to be real sensitive about my personal conduct. So that's always a real sticking point. And then the other is the responsibility for NCAA infractions. It's easy that the coach is responsible for himself because the bylaws say that the contract has to contain that provision. But where I really push and have been successful, because the coaches that the schools I represented have been, you know, they've been willing to accept responsibility for their assistants, is to make sure that contract is clear, is that we're not going to let you stick your head in the sand and ignore what your assistants do and then plead innocence, is that you pick them, you hire them, they're yours. And you really have to make sure you have that button down to protect the school.
Real quick, we obviously from the national office don't get involved in the negotiations of contracts between institutions and coaches. We do have a resource page on NCAA.org. If you put coaches' contracts in the search function, you'll come to it, and it just has different case law, it has different provisions, sample provisions from various contracts. But one of the things, particularly after the Ohio State O'Brien litigation, was the whole infractions issue. It costs universities lots of money to go through this process between in front of these two committees, and you know, various other things in terms of vacations of records, etc. So it's really important in the contracts that there is some provision that deals specifically with infractions, so that the university has something in writing that gives them some abilities to deal with the coach in those instances. So that's really important.
Let me say, I mean, I think Naima has raised a great, if you really want to read a very, very good thing, not necessarily the infractions committee and the appeals as it relates to Ohio State and Jeremiah, but go to the State of Ohio case where Coach O'Brien basically sued Ohio State. And in that contract, and I'm familiar with that because I was at Ohio State when they hired Jim O'Brien, there actually was a reference to infractions and the breaking of NCAA rules. And I think that brings into another question, is when do you actually break an NCAA rule? And so I would say in that case, you know, this whole kind of concept of ready, aim, and fire, and in that case, I would say Ohio State forgot to ready and aim. They just fired. And the fact of the matter is, if breaking the rule means you have to go through Gene's committee and my committee to a final resolution, and that process can take a year, when did you break the rule? And so, you know, I think that's what happened in there. The other piece I would say, the other part of contracts with coaches that is somewhat troubling is if you take the issue of a regular contract and when we get into a breach. And William is absolutely right. I mean, and I'm sure most of you law students and lawyers understand that, you know, the bad part about being a lawyer is I always say lawyers come in at a wedding and talk about divorce. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, now when you guys are going to get a divorce, let's get this straightened out now. Well, you've just spoiled the party. You know, everybody's like celebrating and you're talking about when this is going to go bad. But that's your job. It's the train wreck. Well, the fact of the matter is, if you figure that all marriages end in 50% end in divorce, well, 50% of contracts go end in breach. Okay, and so what happens at that point in time? Well, in this world, you then have a situation of trying to figure out what the damages are. In other words, we got a 5-year, 6-year contract, coach is very successful, another school calls, he or she wants to walk, you breach the contract, what's the damages? And so we start to get to this position of trying to basically outline what the damages are in the contract. And that basically comes about, the coach says, well, if you fire me before, I want to be paid a whole bunch of money. I want to be paid that base salary plus all that guarantee that you gave me. And on the other hand, we, the university, says, and if you walk away, there's a buyout. Well, where the problem has come in is any coach that's walking away from you, the other school is picking up the buyout. And it's just made the business, I mean, it has put the coaches, you know, I mean, I'm not saying anything bad about the coaches, but you're absolutely right. The coaches have all the bargaining power. They have absolutely all the bargaining power. Because every coach that is getting ready to go to another job, if that other school wants them, they have already recognized the fact, and they've looked at it. Now, save the fact that there was a little issue up in Ann Arbor last year when they finally realized how much West Virginia was going to have to be paid. But even in there, they came into some sort of agreement of how much University of Michigan would pay and how much Coach Rodriguez would pay. And I would love to have been a fly on the wall to find out how much of what Rodriguez is going to pay is actually going to come from Michigan. But the fact of the matter is those buyouts have really put the coaches in a very, very strong bargaining power.
One thing I'd add back to the Ohio State case that David mentioned, in case you're not familiar with it, Ohio State had a basketball coach named Jim O'Brien. Long story short, he was very successful. Then they had compliance issues. They terminated him. They terminated him when they found out and concluded that there had been rules violations involving the payment to a player. They didn't wait for the NCAA process to run its course. The contract language said if he's found guilty of major violations. Well, the NCAA Committee on Infractions makes that determination. He sued the university and said, when you fired me, I had not been found guilty of violations. So you owe me you didn't have grounds to terminate me. And what was it, David, $2.5 million? He won. And so I followed that case very carefully. What our contracts say now is that if we decide, or the conference decides, or the NCAA decides, any of the three, if we decide that you've done it, then we can cut you loose. Also, I've built in, there are cases where, and I've been involved in them, where the NCAA was convinced that there were major violations by my client. The coaches denied it, and we weren't sure how it was going to turn out. So the way we handle that in the contract is to say, coach, we have the right to suspend some of the payments, not your base salary, but the payments for the media rights and all that, which is where the real money is. We can suspend those while the investigation is pending, and if you're cleared, you'll get the money back with interest. But if you're not, you know, if you're found guilty, that's it. The other thing about buyouts and terminations is interesting. Is David's right. The school that's trying to hire your coach has already factored that in before they come after him. But I will say, and back to Coach Tuberville, and this is all public information, so I'm not saying anything that I shouldn't. His contract, he had a very lucrative buyout that if he was fired without cause, very lucrative. And the flip side was is that if he left for another job, it was dollar for dollar the same. And it was really, I think, fairly unique in college football. And I am convinced that was a real deterrent, and some schools that had very attractive jobs and plenty of money, but they just weren't willing to pay at that time $6 or $7 million just to have the right to talk to him about coming to work for them. So it can be a deterrent, but what I always tell my clients is that the bottom line is that if you have a coach that doesn't want to be there, you're probably better off with him going somewhere else anyway. Making your coach stay is not going to be a good situation eventually anyway.
I'm going to do a couple of quick hitters here, I think, and then we'll start to take some questions from you guys. So think about what you might want to ask. And we can just run down the panel. I mean, we talk about $4 million. It seems that the Nick Saban contract, even though it's not the biggest contract anymore, I think Pete Carroll at USC has the most money. $4.5 million is a big deal now. I remember it was only about 10 or 12 years ago that the first coach started making $1 million, and everybody was up in arms over that. We're up in arms over $4 million now. Where are coaching salaries going for major programs like that? Just, I'm interested. I'll start down at the other end with Mr. King. Just run down. I mean, in 10 years, what are we going to be saying? What's that number? And is $4.5 million going to seem like $1 million does now, like pocket change?
I'm a believer in the free market, and when it comes to that sport in particular, the market across the country, that's what it is, because that's the kind of money that the sport generates. At most schools, successful football programs pay for the rest of the athletic department. And as long as university presidents and athletic directors believe that they will get a good return on their investment, then they'll pay what it takes. And when Alabama hired Nick Saban, I live in Alabama, and everybody thought this is ridiculous. I wonder what the poll would be in the athletic department of the president's office today. Are we getting our bang for our buck? They just announced they're going to add 9,000 seats to the stadium with like 20 or 30 skyboxes that are going at $500,000 a pop, and there's a waiting line.
Right.
These tickets are gone, and it's insane. I mean, it's you know, the people who are doing that, by and large, really should be spending that money on something else, a little more essential to their well-being. But that, you know, my wife and I got in an argument about this the other night, because she's right that from a moral and practical standpoint, it makes no sense. And I told her, but that's the way it is, and it's not going to change anytime soon.
Mr. Marsh?
I think probably 5 years ago there was a symposium just like this, and I think I sat in the same seat. I swear, I think I was right here. And I said then that in order to change the salary issue, it takes individual acts of courage of university presidents and boards of directors to decide we're not going to get in that game. And they take heat for it, and they whatever, just like Vanderbilt takes heat for doing what it did when it restructured its program. But my whole belief after 9 years on the infractions committee and all this stuff is that you can have all these hands, you can fill this room up with university presidents, and it happens where they all talk about the arms race is out of control. Miles Brand gives speeches, the arms race is out of control. But the lick log is when you go back to campus, do you fold? Do you decide to pay the coach? That's whether you either have courage or you don't have any courage. And I don't agree that it's okay just because now the coach is making enough money to pay for the rest of the football program. It's also part of what I led with, and that is sort of what's your brand? Like, right. What do you stand for? I ran the University Honors Program for 4 years when I was living in two worlds of teaching undergraduates and also in the law school. And we recruited heavily, you know, in high schools. And I can't tell you how many high schools I would go to where they, and this is way back in time, but where they would have, like, one AP course or,
right.
You know, a sort of fairly miserable setup for their science labs, yet they had a high school football program that was loaded for bear and a booster organization and whatever. And you can say, well, if you say, well, that's okay because they raised their own money, I just don't agree with that. In part, you make a statement when you decide to spend that kind of money, even though you're in the black, you make a statement about what your brand is, what is important to you. And that's the part I just will never surrender on, that idea that if you just make decisions based on, well, the coach is worth it because we can net $8 million, it still says what you're all about. What you're all about is when you open up your alumni magazine and it looks more like a media guide for the football program than it does a report on what's going on campus, then that's your brand. And I that's just where I just fundamentally will never agree with the idea that if you just make enough money, then it's okay to pay the coach whatever. I just don't buy that. I think it's obscene.
Mr. Williams, you said, and I'm going to lead this in, and then I want to hear what you said. You said that big college athletics is big business. Is part of the distinction that college athletic programs are run like a big business? College is not run like necessarily like a big business. You may disagree. You see both sides. I'm interested, and then you can go
well,
with the salary.
Yeah, talk. Colleges are, you know, it's interesting because when I was – before I went into college administration, just as a law professor, I thought it was very, very, that college was a very pristine, pure thing. And then when I got on the other side, I realized there's a whole bunch of people that basically deal with colleges as a business.
Right.
I'm in that side now. So, you know, we run it as a business and we make mistakes like businesses too. But, you know, I think that there's, you know, we all talk about the sort of market driven. And we need to understand there's a whole nother market out there, and that's the market of public opinion.
Right.
And to have two SEC schools recently, as we are sitting in the worst economic crisis that this country has faced since the Great Depression, to basically say, I got to hire a football coach, I got to hire a basketball coach, and money is no object while that universities are laying people off, eventually that will catch up with you. Because Gene is absolutely right. It basically starts to say who you are. And while I agree with, I mean, if it's the NFL, pay them whatever they can get. But when you bring it to a college campus and you're raising tuition, you're telling the rest of the university there's no raises, there's no hiring, we're going to lay you off, it is just immoral to basically go out and say, we'll pay a basketball coach, we'll pay a football coach, whatever it costs. whatever it costs. Money is no object. I think the market of public opinion will eventually catch up with us in the universities. We'll lead our own.
Last question, bringing it back to the NCAA. One of the issues that I think a lot of fans and a lot of the media have and the public opinion has is that it seems sometimes like the NCAA is effectively working as a traffic cop. Everybody's going at a certain speed, and randomly they pull people out and accuse them of committing violations in some sort of form or fashion. You guys have experience with this. If you just said roughly, what percentage of major infractions actually get caught by the NCAA?
Well, let me just start by saying it's not a selective enforcement process. It's not like the enforcement staff is hanging out on campuses
right.
saying, gotcha. A lot of the report, you know, nothing is followed up on from the enforcement staff perspective before it even gets to these committees until it's reported.
Yeah, and tell us how something gets reported, maybe as a baseline before we
get into. First of all, it comes from a wide variety of sources, including
okay.
the media sometimes. It comes from other schools telling on their competitor up the street or in their conference. It comes from ex-girlfriends, ex-boyfriends who helped write that paper for the student athlete when they weren't supposed to. I mean, the information comes from everywhere. And, you know, this has been a very Division I specific conversation. There are three divisions
right.
and that make up the NCAA, and the enforcement staff of about 30 people is responsible for enforcing the rules for that entire population, over 1,200 institutions. So that's a lofty task.
Right.
So they can only follow up on information that is reported. And then, you know, so the landscape out there, you know, I know fans know of whatever they know of about their competitor school or et cetera, and it's difficult to see why is my school getting beat up on when the school up the street is doing X, Y, Z. Well, unless
right.
that information comes into the staff, there's no way to enforce the rule in that way. Now, there is what's called the basketball focus group that just got established. It's a subset of the enforcement staff that is looking into basketball recruiting issues, et cetera, because that has been something that the membership has, you know, really voiced some concern about. But again, it still won't be until the information is of a credible level
right.
that an actual enforcement action is started and then can possibly make its way through the process.
But just in general, for people who have dealt with these situations, what percentage of actual major infractions does the NCAA actually have an opportunity to levy a penalty for? I mean, in other words, is that accurate, that it's the equivalent? I mean, that there's a lot more infractions than actually take place, major infractions. I'm not talking about minor infractions, just from you guys' perspective.
And well, I mean, what's your point? I mean, is there a whole lot more tax cheating that goes on, that occurs, that doesn't get caught? Yes, but what's your point? Shut the IRS down? I don't understand.
No, there's not a point. I'm just saying the perception is that there is a point. The perception is that they're not, that they're not completely it's a thankless job. But my question is still, how prevalent is cheating in the NCAA? And if the NCAA is only catching 2% of cheating, that to me means that the NCAA is not effectively being able to police its own group.
But I think the problem you have with that is, in order to say it's 2%, you have to have some baseline of knowing there's more cheating out there.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, I think the answer is we just don't know.
Okay.
I mean, we don't know what everybody's doing. And if you listen to people, everybody will tell you about that story about how they got that kid or how they did that. And you don't know if it's true or not. I mean, I'm by training a tax attorney, and the tax code is 2 volumes and 6 regulations, and this book is harder to understand. This book is harder to understand
and
has a less enforcement ability because, you know, in many cases, the NCAA, if you want to say, they're really dependent on people coming forth.
Right.
And you know, people will and will not come forth for different reasons. So, I mean, I think they do as good a job as can be expected, but you have an environment. And you distinguish between major violations and minor violations or secondary violations and major violations. But you have to understand that a string of secondary violations can take you to major violations.
Right.
Well, you cannot operate a Division I athletic program without having secondary violations. If you go 3 years and you're not reporting a secondary violation, you will get a call from the NCAA because it's impossible.
Right. Right.
So you got a situation that's ripe for breaking the rules, and we don't have the ability to figure out what everybody's doing behind closed doors. You know, from running an athletic department and a small one here, I am constantly worried about things that I don't know what's going on.
Right.
And you try to do checks and balances. You kind of walk in one day and say to your compliance people, okay, everybody empty their desks. I want to make sure nobody's writing exams for people. I mean, you just can't follow all of these things.
And that's one last. Mr. King, you do an awful lot of compliance work, going to the schools and trying to teach these coaches, these assistant coaches, these head coaches. How well do they understand the rules that they're being forced to apply on a daily basis as a group? And how complicated is that to apply? We just saw this rule book.
The rule book is very difficult, and I've worked with it. I come to this a little different angle because I've never worked for a university. I've never worked for the NCAA. I've never worked for a conference. So I think I really have a different perspective on it because I really am kind of just like a disinterested observer who kind of strolled up and said, oh, okay, well, here's what I think. Schools are very committed to rules education. Most schools have a meeting every month. The coaches have to take the test before they can go on the road to recruit. The schools are devoting the time and effort to try to educate the coaches. I spoke at 12 schools last year. Obviously, I'm a very dynamic speaker. And at every one of them, there was somebody snoring and drooling in their coffee. And not because they were disrespectful, but probably because they'd been on the road recruiting till 2 o'clock the night before or whatever. So, you know, the level of actual knowledge varies greatly. The schools are trying to do it the right way. They are. I'll tell you that. The other thing, too, and I have been surprised by this, is, you know, your team never cheats. Your rival, they're the dirtiest team ever. And
right.
They're terrible, and their coaches are buying every single player. I have been really surprised at how rare it is that a coach truly is a bad apple who is just a renegade disregard for the bylaws. I've also been surprised that the schools report it. If they have a problem and they know about it, they know the risk of sweeping it under the rug and ignoring it is so huge that if they do that and they have a major and then they hide it and then they get caught, it really rarely happens. The great unknown are the boosters. What are they doing for the athletes? And if I decide tomorrow as a Vanderbilt law alum that I want to go pay a Vanderbilt basketball player and I find a ready, willing, and able participant, there is nothing that David Williams can do to stop that. It is going to happen, and Vanderbilt's going to get in trouble for that. That's the great unknown. The second great unknown is how much do your coaches know about that? That they're not directly involved, but they know the player came back with nice clothes and a car or new stereo or something that's not right.
Right.
And then that's kind of the gray area. That's what I see. The answer to your first question is how much is being detected and how much is going undetected. I have literally no clue, nor do I know anyone who does.
Okay.
Can I ask something real quick,
yeah.
Clay? I know we want to get to questions, but I think both William and David both made important points. First, the secondary infractions process is different than major. And schools, like both have just said, report thousands of secondaries. So what happens is a secondary can quickly become a major if you don't report it. And if athletics administrators have knowledge of something that they don't report, because now they've done two things wrong, the underlying violation and then not reporting it. This is a self-governing, self-enforcing, tell-on-yourself kind of paradigm that we have here. So people do report secondaries all the time. That staff is very busy. It doesn't turn into a major until You know, it's really the egregious conduct where it can't be processed as secondary or you don't report it. Second, in terms of the head coach's responsibility not to stick their head in the sand, I think William referenced it when we were talking about the coaches' contracts. And in terms of making sure that you're running a clean program, there's also now legislation that not only the institution has a failure to monitor or lack of institutional control charge that can be brought against them, but a head coach's failure to monitor can also be charged, and that's in Bylaw 11. So it's putting more of an onus on the head coaches to not turn a blind eye to things that might look kind of strange.
Just in case you're wondering, my client was found guilty not only of violations but failure to monitor as well, the coach. So absolutely, she's right. Coaches can be found guilty of failure to monitor.
And you know, William, you said that your experiences from defending coaches and institutions, and you said you haven't found a great percentage of people who just sort of knew that they were out there machining something or whatever. I spent 9 years on the committee. I think my conclusion is completely the opposite. This rule book is confusing, but the rules that get most folks in front of my committee are not.
I agree with that 100%.
When it comes to, did you know that was a recruiting violation? Did you know piping money to the kid was an extra benefit? Did you or should you have known that there was academic fraud? That's about 90% of all the cases that I heard in 9 years. And if I had this room filled with all those sinners of various degrees, you know, they'd be all sin, but it's all a matter of degree. If I could say to them, did you know that what got you here today was the wrong thing to do and that it was a violation of what are a few fundamental rules? If they were all being held to the standard of their maker, about 95% of the hands in the room would go up, yes. So this idea that, oh, I just got chewed up on the system because I just didn't understand all these goofy rules. Cock-a-rocka. That is just not.
I agree with that, James.
Not
the,
true.
The stuff that people get in trouble for, you don't need a rule book to know you shouldn't be doing.
That's a defense that we just listen goes in, no matter if it's the lawyer saying it or the coach saying it, just goes whistling right through here and right out there and doesn't even make a stop.
Questions from you guys? I'll start left and work my way across right, so just keep your hands up as soon as... Yes?
You mentioned this basketball focus group. I myself am very much concerned about the abysmal graduation rate of college basketball. Somebody just shed a little light on what is being done, can be done, or throw the hands up. It's getting worse and worse.
A couple of things. One, I think David mentioned a little earlier, some of the student first kind of paradigm that Miles Brand as the president has really been trying to push forward is part of this academic performance rate. And this is not specific to basketball. We've actually had our first set of schools go through hearings similar in some respects to what the committee on Committee on Infractions and Infractions Appeals Committee hears, simply as it relates to these very issues for specific sports at an institution. So their graduation rate, you know, the overall academic performance of particular teams, and they can face penalties almost as stiff, if not more so, than what the infractions process on the other side could yield, including postseason bans. And next year we'll see schools reaching provisional membership status, possibly, which is the worst thing that you would want to happen as an NCAA member institution. So that on the academic, in addition to the fact that they are also going to start compiling APR rates or APR profiles for coaches. So a coach that has consistently had underperforming student athletes on their team, college universities and universities presidents and athletic directors will have that information to see. So now we're really going to see where the rubber hits the road, if they will have the courage, as Professor Marsh says it, to not only look at the wins and loss records of these particular coaches, but they also need to look at their academic performance profile for the types of kids they're recruiting and if they're helping them really get the education that the scholarship is providing. So those, in addition to the basketball focus group, which is going to go out to some of these summer events and go to different areas where we think there might be some cause for concern and try to develop the information that then might be moved to a major case, and then maybe we'll see some of the behavior changes. But it's going to be a work in progress, definitely.
I think the other piece is, you know, one part that bothers me, I mean, Naomi, so she's right. I mean, there's stuff coming down the pipeline. I would submit to you the presidents and the athletic directors have always known what was the academic profile of the coaches they were hiring. Now we're just going to make them walk around with a card with it on. We knew it. I mean, and they keep getting hired. The problem is you have to break down this concept of belief that you can only win in basketball with kids that don't graduate or are not interested. I mean, we had a team that made it to the NCAAs last year. We had 5 seniors, all of them graduated. It can be done. It's just nobody has the courage to basically say, this is going to be operated as a university. And, you know, my displeasure is they've started some of the academic basketball focus groups. And the last meeting that I went to, which was just a week ago, Monday, at our SEC meetings, the bad report was all of the great stuff that had been talking about is starting to whittle down. I mean, there was the discussion about we have such a bad situation, all basketball players coming in need to come to pre-summer school, or at least the ones that are listed as at risk. Well, they're getting ready to take that off the table. I mean, the fact of the matter is we got to get to a point where we get back to that basic value, that basically graduation, and I get really disturbed when people say it's progress to degree, and the pros will come and get the kid. You know, we will not sit, quite honestly, and talk to a kid and a parent if they sit in front of us and say, we really just want our kid to come to your school for 1 year and go to the pros. Then you're not coming to Vanderbilt to play basketball.
Although, you know, from a Title IX perspective, just looking historically, the attempt to make data objective so that the public can look at it and see whether or not students are graduating, historically that made it exposed a lot of the inequities from the Title IX standpoint. And again, I'm talking historically, and things have changed more recently. But once you start publishing data or making it objective, available, and capable of analysis, that's going to lead to more eyes looking at what's happening. In a Title IX arena, historically, it helped to put a spotlight on some of the equities.
But the APRs, if actually we start snatching scholarships, taking money, not letting them go in the postseason, you'll start to see people change.
Yeah. And that's
going to have to happen.
It's coming.
And here's the trick to it. It has to happen at the big programs. You can't do it for the little bitty programs that made it to the tournament once out of the last 15 years. You got to hit those. I mean, you know, every year you see in USA Today, they say, here's the number of schools that are in the final 64 that have a graduation rate of less than 20% or are below 925 on the APR, which is the magic number. I think the magic number now is lowered down to 900. They've gone and said, well, you got to have under 900, which is like, well, you know, 2 years ago was 925. What happened? Did we all get stupider? That you got to lower it down? So they've lowered those standards down. So we're going to see what happens. And they need to basically say, okay, you know, you didn't hit the number, whatever the number is. You don't even worry about having your selection party. You're not going. We don't care if you're rated number one or not. I don't think they have the will to do it. I really don't.
I think you're also going to see in the coaches' contracts right now, some schools have started offering bonuses for higher APRs, and I think if you really want it to work, is there are going to have to be penalties for low APRs. And then the question becomes, do you really want your coaches that directly involved in the academics? Is that their job? Is it a good idea to have them involved? And I'm not sure I know the answer to that one.
Well, one of the things we've gotten to, which is interesting, that's a great point, we basically pay bonuses for people to do what they're supposed to do. You know, I love the fact each of my coaches come in, well, I won X amount of games this year. Don't I get a bonus? What do you think we hired you for? It's like, you know, I taught 20 law students this year as opposed to 18. I should get a bonus. But now you're right, and so we're basically, if you graduate kids, we give you a bonus. If you go to the tournament, you get a bonus. If you fill the gym, you get a bonus. It's like, well, I guess what we were really paying you for was mediocrity.
And the academic issue is, what I tell my clients is especially with high school kids that are trying to get into school, is not only are you not turning that over to the coach, you keep him or her out of that process. That has to be handled by the people who normally handle it, because if there are any issues about what transcripts being changed or things like that, and that coach is near there, then we're going to go get to Indianapolis to see Naima and her people, and we don't want any part of that.
Let's get a couple more questions if we could. Yes.
No, it would have to be like time. So, yes, if we were talking about a scenario of cash payments, then it would have to be cash payments on the other side. As I've said before, I don't think we're ever going to see cash. It's going to change the NCAA's world too much. But if you're talking about specifically scholarships or other categories that can get lumped into the financial aid package or the grant and aid package, it's got to be applicable on both sides. And again, it's an aggregated level, so it's not like you have to pay certain players the same on each side. If you want to take $1 million and give it to the football team, and you want to take $1 million and just spread equally amongst every female athlete, you can do that. And again, we would have to get into math. It's not a 50-50. I really don't want to get into that.
You, and then we've got you two. You first. Yes.
Okay. My question would be, I know you guys talk about employment. Now, I know there might be an issue about future prospects going to a university. Now, how is it, if you can, you know, especially about family members actually being employed at the university, allowing that person to maybe go to school for free, allowing more scholarships to open up for, you know, more players? I mean, is that an issue? I mean, is that possible, or is that breaking rules for, you know, a family member to be employed at the school, allowing that, you know, the student to be able to go to school for free, still being able to play, which will allow him to be a walk-on, and then still getting money for, you know, future scholarships?
Well, if they're recruitable, they're counted against us anyway. But, you know, I was at a meeting the other day, and the people got to talking about the economy, and this one guy said, the problem with the economy is, I won't go into a long thing, but how money try to follows return. And what happened is money's not going to the emerging markets, it's coming back to the United States where there's no return. But there's these smart kids that graduate from schools like Vanderbilt that basically create these artificial type vehicles, you know, swaps and things. You see the same thing in athletics. In other words, one of the things that happens is everybody is trying to create a better mousetrap. And so, sure, the fact of the matter that there is an opportunity to go to school free if your parent is an employee there, and whether or not we can manipulate the rules, or someone can manipulate the rules by doing something that has been pretty much done a lot without the free part of it, is I really want you to come here and play basketball, so let's hire your dad in some role. Well, you know, that can be conceived as legitimate somehow, and once dad is there, if the university rule is, in most places generally have a length time that you have to be employee, but there are some that don't have that, well, then you do have a kid that legitimately can go to school free, and at least at a minimum the athletic department is not paying for that, because that's a benefit for the employee. I think the crutch of it is, do you have that linkage between recruiting the kid and hiring the relative?
If you do, then that's a problem.
Yeah, but you got to prove that one. And the fact of the matter is, you know, I can give you five in the last 15 years and names that just would ring your bell where universities basically hired the father. I mean, just straight out. And it was just like everybody's like, oh, and nothing ever happened. I mean, University of Kansas is a great example.
Yep. And also the another trend that's gotten a lot of press is hiring the high school or summer basketball coach of a player that everyone knows is going to go wherever the summer coach goes. There was a very high-profile player who's now played 1 year and is now in the NBA, and his summer coach is still at the school, and I think salaries.
As paid assistant
basketball. Two or three times what a normal assistant salary is for a basketball coach.
That can backfire, too. Arkansas, where they hired the high school coach. They got the star quarterback. And then, I forget which one happened first. I think that the assistant coach moved on to a different program, and then the quarterback ended up transferring.
You know, the other piece, one of the things that I think we sometimes do live in a sort of our heads in the sand, and one of the issues that I think I wish we the membership would face up on is we try to make this argument that the student athletes, in many cases that we recruit, are basically recruited and have fallen in love with the school, when the fact of the matter is many of them they've fallen in love with the coach and the system. And so we don't seem to bifurcate that. We still want to say, well, you really came to Vanderbilt because it was Vanderbilt. Well, many cases, it was really the coach that brought the kid there, and that might be that system. And so I think there's still some work we have to do as it relates to recognizing really what is happening in the marketplace. I mean, these kids are at 18 years old. I mean, the great example of it is how nice does your facilities have to be? Well, you know, my daughter is a freshman swimmer at Brown. You want to see a crappy dorm, go where she's at. But the fact of the matter is, if she was going to school and trying to get a scholarship, the pool, the dorm, everything, you know, those things become very important. And so we get into an arms race on facilities, partly because we want to have good, safe facilities, but partly because we're trying to convince 18-year-olds that we got all the bells and whistles and you need to come here. Absolutely.
Last question.
I work for the State Board of Education here, and we often are having to teach civics lessons, like it sounds like you all do, about the role of the legislature, the state, local board of education, and in terms of governing education. You all have to do the same thing with the NCAA members, et cetera. Any particular tips about how you're able to teach those civics lessons in order to help people know where to go to try and change things and reform things? So I have a good perception that the NCAA in Indianapolis is running things. I'm not going to know the best way to try and head off some of these things that pastors try and do education reform, academic reform, things in the way. So, do you have any tips about how you teach those lessons?
Well, I'll tell you from a university point of view, one of the things that we do, and we do it almost on an every other day basis, the NCAA staff is exceedingly good at interacting with you. And so I would say utilize the NCAA because they'll send people out to your campus. They'll do anything to help you learn. The other piece from a university point of view is the most important person that I have on my staff is none of the coaches, is my compliance officer. And she works harder than anybody in there. And not only does she have to have knowledge base, she has to have the ability for everybody to trust her. Because what you want is everybody on your staff to feel comfortable that when they have a question, that they're going to go to her. And so I don't think you can ever educate everybody, but you have to open the door where people basically say, if I have any question whatsoever, let me go somewhere. And I think that's an environment you just have to set up. And you got to have a person in there that, you know, I always say that the two jobs that you're going to find that are going to basically people in athletics burn out, academic counselor and compliance.
Another thing, too, the national office hosts what is called regional rules seminars twice a year, one more on the East Coast, one closer to the West Coast. And it's important to not only have your compliance folks and your athletic staff. Coaches would be nice. They don't often attend those unless they're told to by the Committee on Infractions. but also your registrars, your folks in other parts of campus that interact with student athletes, it's really important to have some representation there so that they're part of what's going on and how the landscape has changed. So that's another good resource.
Well, I'd just like to say thanks to our panelists. Thanks to Vanderbilt for doing a great job putting this event on. And I hope that you guys have enjoyed our discussion. And we look forward to seeing some of you at lunch. Thank you.